You can shop in stores or you can shop online and then go to the store when the website crashes. But whatever you do, eat your dinner first, won't you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl, who is eating some turkey right about now. It's Thursday, November 23rd. It is good to be with you on this Thanksgiving Day. Listeners with little kitties nearby, potential Christmas spoiler ahead in 3, 2, 1. Okay. So starting this year, Macy's Herald Square is now requiring an online reservation for visits with Santa. The explanation? Santa is a popular guy. Approximately 250,000 visitors come to Macy's Santaland each year, according to the company, meaning Santa visits are a big draw and can translate into big sales for retailers. We sent Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson in search of Santanomics.
True, it's only Thanksgiving, but Santa's helpers have been greeting kids at an upscale shopping center in Walnut Creek, California, for a couple of weeks already. That's where I reached Santa John.
In the beginning, there's 25 to 30, and then after that, it probably goes to 50 to at least 100 a day.
He's not a ho-ho-ho kind of a Santa, but he does try and suss out that whole naughty or nice thing with kids.
I talk to them about their Christmas wishes, and I ask them about their vegetables and how clean their room is and how they listen to mom and dad.
If bricks and mortar retailers could create, you know, a Santa-like experience year-round, they'd be in much better shape.
Pete Killian covers retail for the Cambridge Group.
Santa is the ultimate buffer against digital disruption. It's hard to imagine a digital Santa with, you know, a digital lap.
Killian says retail Santas are what's known in the industry as a trip driver.
Something that'll drive shoppers into stores that maybe they otherwise wouldn't have come in person.
In-person shoppers mean impulse buying and bigger baskets at checkout. Online shoppers tend to spearfish, a.k.a. go hunting for just the thing they want.
Buy that item, check out, and buy nothing else.
Yep, Santa is bait to get shoppers spending, says Marshall Cohen with the MPD Group.
Santa drives impulse. It's fun. It puts us in the spirit. You can't not visit a toy store or some store that's in the mall when kids are in tow.
Cohen says he actually studies Santa lines and how they compare to previous years as a way to gauge holiday shopping traffic. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Out of the Santa bait stores and onto the internet. The latest holiday shopping survey from Deloitte says 91% of the people shopping this holiday weekend will do at least some of it online. Some, like me, have already started deal hunting. But there is a downside to online shopping. I'm not naming names here, but I tried for at least an hour to buy a game console from a popular online retailer last night, and the site just would not work. And by the time I got up this morning, there were none left to buy online. I know I am breaking your heart, but seriously, if retailers know the traffic to their websites is going to be crazy on Thanksgiving weekend, why does this keep happening? Marketplace's Andy Euler asked around.
Back in the day, holiday shopping frustration was about waiting in line, getting stepped on at the mall. Nowadays, it's more about paying for the discounted items in your online shopping cart, and the digital register decides to take a digital smoke break. You get an error page, and you miss out on the sale. Bob Phibbs is CEO of The Retail Doctor, a consultancy firm in New York. He says companies still think about their websites the same way they think about their storefronts.
You don't build the store for Black Friday crowds. You build the store for year-long.
The data tell us people are shifting their shopping habits online. So why aren't retailers shifting their resources to make sure their websites work? Andy Still is Chief Technology Officer at Intechnica, the company that tests whether websites are prepared for an increase in traffic. He says companies that struggle to cope with website functionality could throw a bunch of money into making sure their sites don't crash, but
quite often it's not economic to scale to these sort of levels because you're essentially scaling your system by 10, 20 times capacity to be able to serve traffic just for one day of the year.
He says many websites also use third-party companies to process payments and deal with shipping. Think PayPal or UPS. Making sure those websites don't crash is another concern and expense these retailers have to account for. Still says until the shopping transaction becomes one seamless enterprise, the days of the error page are going to be here for a while. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Markets are closed today for the holiday. Futures are up. Oil globally is booming. More details when we do the numbers. After an unprecedented few months of disasters, including Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, lots of folks are thinking a lot harder about climate change. Recent studies project that some 13 million coastal Americans are likely to be displaced by sea level rise by the end of this century. Florida is particularly vulnerable because it is a peninsula. One community, Satellite Beach, is taking the, and it's a surprise to say this, but the unusual step of planning ahead. Amy Green of WMFE in Central Florida reports.
Satellite Beach is a quiet community of some 10,000, established by rocket scientists a half century ago near Kennedy Space Center. It's situated on a barrier island between the Atlantic Ocean and a 156-mile Indian River lagoon. Here, surfers paddle beyond the break, hoping to catch a wave. The waves are a draw and threat. Just up the beach, homes perched near the edge of a 10-foot sand dune. Left exposed after a series of storms and hurricanes washed away a seawall, John Fergus says the beach is disappearing.
Right now, we don't have problems other than eroding ocean shoreline. We're blessed. We're not like South Florida, where they get king tides that flood streets and all kinds of stuff like that. But it's coming.
Fergus has lived here since 1978, when he was assigned to nearby Patrick Air Force Base. Now retired, he's part of a community effort to plan for sea level rise that's projected to threaten homes and important buildings like City Hall by mid-century, a little more than a mortgage's lifetime away. Courtney Barker is Satellite Beach's city manager.
We believe that in about 40 or 50 years, you'll see there will be areas of the city with standing water. So those areas will either be, will either engineer our way out of it, like, you know, where you see Miami Beach actually raising roads, or we will retreat.
She eyes a retention pond in front of City Hall. A fountain springs from its center. The pond drains to the Indian River Lagoon and is prone to flooding when the lagoon is high. The problem is getting worse. The community was among the first in Florida to commission a study on its vulnerability to rising sea level. Barker says leaders now are considering how to make changes through building and zoning regulations. For instance, should different height restrictions apply to property owners who want to construct homes on stilts? She says there would be economic consequences if, for example, residents were to limit development on oceanfront property.
When we take a property off the tax rolls along the ocean, which is the highest taxable value property in the city, that pushes that tax burden onto the rest of the community. So people would need to understand that. The more we prevent people from building, the more people will pay for the services.
Satellite Beach is an outlier in a state where leaders have offered little guidance on the problem of sea level rise. Ken Linneman is a resident and climate change expert at the Florida Institute of Technology.
Many places are going to move forward and adapt as they can from the bottom up, whether they get support from the top down or not, whether they get federal support, whether they get state support.
Back on the beach, resident John Fergus considers the community's future.
Eventually, people in vulnerable properties are going to be in trouble. You could just say, too bad, bad luck, you're done.
But he says that would be wrong.
If you have 40 years, that's probably not the right answer.
The effort is difficult because at its heart is not only Satellite Beach's future, but also its character. Residents like their community the way it is. Fergus says it can stay that way with the right planning. In Satellite Beach, Florida, I'm Amy Green for Marketplace.
What is the best part about reading the newspaper? Don't think about it too hard. It's the comics. Or at least it was. Weekly comics have fallen out of favor, along with, you know, print readership overall. But comics still have a place in our hearts and our society. And for Colin Murphy, they represent his childhood. Colin's father, John Murphy, was a popular cartoonist during the heyday of the form. And Colin has a new book out about growing up comic. It's called Cartoon County. Colin Murphy joins me now. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Molly.
So this is such a story of your childhood, which is so different and unique and special. What was it like growing up with a cartoonist for a dad?
It was pretty wonderful. You have to remember that I grew up in a part of Connecticut where most people were not cartoonists, but there was a group of about 100 people who were. Most of the people were commuters, but the cartoonists stayed home, and my dad was one of those. He did a strip called Big Ben Bold, which was about a prize fighter, and then he did a strip called Prince Valiant, which was about a knight in the Middle Ages. And after school, unlike almost any other kid in the neighborhood, we could go to the studio and basically hang out.
And did people, I mean, you said that there was this sort of community all around of people doing the same thing, but did people outside of his community take his job seriously?
I don't think my mother's parents ever really fully accepted that what he did was work. I don't think he really regarded what he did as work. One of the happiest places that he ever spent time in was the studio. His family came out there all the time. He was living in something of an invented world, creating stories that weren't real, except that they were putting food on the table.
Talk about the power of images, because, you know, even if there's not the same high value placed on cartoons now, there's still, it seems like the right cartoon at the right moment can have a huge impact politically, socially, all kinds of ways.
There's something about the comic strip form that I think responds to something that's hardwired in the human psyche, this combination of words and picture. There's something about this 1-2 punch that we respond to very powerfully. And I think that's a permanent part of our culture. We see a efflorescence nowadays of graphic novels, which really are the successor to comic strips. But it's fundamentally the same dynamic at work, I think.
Yeah, I almost feel like you could carry that forward and also say that Instagram and internet memes, you know, funny pictures with funny captions are
absolutely
kind of the digital version. So how have technology and specifically the internet impacted the cartoon industry?
Well, they've had a big impact, not directly, but indirectly. The real impact has been on the newspaper business. I think the recent data are that Sunday newspaper readership is down by something like 3 million people a year. And since Sunday newspapers, along with daily newspapers, are the natural ecosystem for comic strips, you don't need McKinsey or Bain to come and tell you what the effect of this is going to be. That's not to say, though, that the form itself, you know, the basic storytelling with images and words is a dying art, because I think it's not. I think we're at the beginning of a new golden age.
Do you have a favorite comic or cartoon strip then or now?
I've always loved Prince Valiant. I think Prince Valiant had the adventure strip. It had the romantic novel. It had some of the humor of what are called, you know, Bigfoot strips, although it's done in a more formal and novelistic way. The illustrations have been, you know, beautiful. And it has really stood the test of time. You know, it's been going since 1937. It's been in, you know, several different hands, but it has, you know, it has gone from glory to glory.
Cullen Murphy is author of Cartoon County, My Father and His Friends in the Golden Age of Make-Believe. Cullen, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks very much, Molly.
Coming up,
my father always said he'd know that mother was ready to do him in if she served him a meal out of a box.
The peanut butter grandma returns. But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., markets are closed for the Thanksgiving holiday. Over in Europe, Britain's FTSE was basically flat. France's CAC 40 rose 0.5%. Germany's DAX dipped less than 0.1%. And in Asia, Japan's Nikkei gained 0.4%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. In case you hadn't heard, reining in federal regulations is a major item on the to-do list of those in power right now.
Ending the culture of overregulation. It's going to take more than a few months, but we have made a good start.
And in the White House,
since taking office, I've signed one action after another to eliminate job-killing regulations that stand in a way.
Those are the voices, of course, of President Trump and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. The chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, did his part this week, announcing a plan to roll back nearly every regulation on internet traffic. The FCC is expected to make the end of net neutrality final in a vote next month. But how did we become a regulatory state in the first place? That's what Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk is exploring in the new season of Marketplace's documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Today, Chrissy brings us the story of how one homemaker's life intersected with the growing regulation of something very basic to our lives, food.
By the time Ruth Desmond was a grandmother in the 1970s, she'd earned a reputation as a powerful consumer activist in our nation's capital. Newspapers called her the, quote, terror of Washington, who spit in the corporate eye.
She did, but nicely.
Ruth Desmond died in 1988 in her 80s. But this woman with the laugh, Janet Swager, knew her well. Way before Ruth was a grandmother or a food activist.
I'm her angel of a daughter. She always called me her angel.
Janet was Ruth's only child. They were always close. Apparently, they had the same laugh. And growing up in the 1950s, Janet spent a lot of time with her mom in the kitchen of their small brick house in Arlington, Virginia. Janet still lives there now. She's 76.
When you look at this room and picture your mom, what would she be doing in it? Where would she be?
Oh, she'd be busy with her blender or her bread maker. You know, her oven would have a roast in it. My father always said he'd know that mother was ready to do him in if she served him a meal out of a box.
And that was only kind of a joke. Ruth really did see food and cooking as matters of life and death because of something that happened in 1955. Ruth's husband, Gordon, Janet's dad,
had come down with bladder cancer.
He was young, in his 40s.
I remember him going in for surgeries and all, and we'd go visit at the hospital.
Before one surgery, Janet remembers, the doctors were talking about the general anesthesia they were going to use on her dad. Her mom overheard them and explained that he'd had a bad reaction to it in an earlier surgery.
Stopped his heart for 3 minutes.
Ruth said instead of general anesthesia, he needed a spinal block, but the doctors ignored her.
So she actually rode the gurney into the surgical room. Laying across his body, saying, you will not give him anesthesia.
That's the kind of person she was.
The kind of person she was. She was determined. So there you go. That was how she looked at everything.
As for Janet's dad's cancer.
Fortunately, he got most of it out. Cut a lot of it out. But mother then wanted it to stay out because bladder cancer is one of those that can reoccur.
And so Ruth started reading up on the latest science about cancer and its potential causes, which led her to these studies on
the potential role of chemical additives and pesticide residues in food.
Angie Boyce is a bioethicist at Johns Hopkins who's written about Ruth Desmond. She says Ruth started looking into the emerging science about these new chemicals that, in the last few decades, food manufacturers were adding to food, and studies that linked some of them to cancer in lab animals. The science was still uncertain, but it raised questions for Ruth about how safe the food was that she was feeding her family. And more importantly, who was supposed to be in charge of figuring out what was safe? And so,
at that point, and I think, you know, this is so Ruth Desmond, she calls the FDA.
They're named the Food and Drug Administration, after all. So Ruth wants to know what they're doing about these chemicals.
And they tell her, if you're interested in this, why don't you, you know, you're local.
She was in Arlington, Virginia, remember, just down the road from the FDA.
Why don't you attend this hearing we're going to have on food additives?
And so Ruth does. The FDA was having these hearings on food additives because at the time, food was in the middle of a complete transformation, prompted by
America goes to war.
Peter Hutt teaches food and drug law at Harvard. Since the 1960s, he's been a lawyer for some of the biggest food companies around.
During World War II, the food science industry went to work and totally changed the American food supply because they were making food to feed our troops all over the world. So that's how the food supply began to change. It became to be a processed food, an engineered food, if you will.
When the war ended, the two biggest industries left standing in America were the chemical industry and the food industry.
People were experimenting with all sorts of chemicals used to preserve foods.
Suzanne Junod is a historian at the FDA.
Honestly, no one knew if they were safe or not, in what amounts they might or might not be safe.
And then, in early November of 1959, just before Thanksgiving, this happened.
We interrupt this program for a special news bulletin.
The FDA announced that inspectors had discovered a crop of cranberries contaminated with a weed killer known to cause cancer in animals. According to federal regulations, farmers were supposed to spray the chemical long enough before harvest that it had time to wear off the berries. But apparently, some bogs got sprayed too late. This was especially jarring for Ruth, Janet says, because
Father liked her to make her famous cranberry jelly from scratch.
The government made a public announcement, warned that if you didn't know exactly where your cranberries came from, this year you should keep them off the Thanksgiving table. And the nation freaked out. Overnight, cranberries disappeared from store shelves. Some states banned the sale of cranberries altogether. Janet remembers her mom reading about it all in the paper.
It was a scandal. They had sprayed the cranberries, and here they are laying out in the grocery stores. And then you find out what they've done to the food before it even gets to the grocery store. And she said, oh my God, you know, I'm killing my husband when I think I'm trying to help him.
Housewives panicked about what to do without their favorite holiday condiment. This song hit the airwaves about the brand new worry all over the nation.
All cranberry got contamination. If you want to be sure of not getting sick, go touch a cranberry with a 10-foot stick.
But the FDA got blamed for overreacting. Richard Nixon and JFK, both running for president, flouted government warnings and very publicly consumed cranberries on the campaign trail. Cranberry growers argued that people would have to eat carloads of cranberries for the pesticide residue to do any harm, and hanged an FDA official in effigy.
Cranberry, cranberry blue.
But while lots of Americans were cursing the FDA, Ruth was cheering.
And said, I'm going to do something about this.
And when there were cranberry hearings in 1959, an organization she'd recently co-founded, the Federation of Homemakers, made a statement defending how the FDA handled the situation, condemning those in the cranberry industry whose, quote, sole concern seems to be a financial one. But this was only a dress rehearsal for something much bigger in Ruth Desmond's future as a consumer activist. Ruth first got wind of this thing when she was sitting in an FDA office and noticed something on the desk, an announcement sparked by a covert action the FDA had recently executed on behalf of peanut butter. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
To hear more of Ruth's story and how she helped change the way we think about food and government regulations through peanut butter, check out that podcast. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This final note before we go, Thanksgiving is a time when lots of people volunteer to help out those in need. Homeless shelters get so many people wanting to serve up turkey dinners that some charities actually ask people to stay home and write a check instead. In Oakland, California, the city's mayor is asking people to tackle homelessness much more directly. Mayor Libby Schaff is asking people to open up their spare rooms or Airbnb rentals to homeless people. About 250 landlords work with a local nonprofit to house the homeless. The mayor says she hopes to add 100 more. And that is it for us. Markets were closed for the Thanksgiving holiday. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Daniel Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I am Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.